Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
For the month of September, we're doing weekly visits and talking about New York real estate. And we're going to check back in with Lockhart Steele, the publisher of the New York real estate blog known as Curbed. Curbed is cheeky. It's informative. Well, Lockhart, you tell me, what's the tone? How do you describe it to someone who hasn't read it before?
Well, Mike, we just try to come at real estate and neighborhood news around New York City with, I think, a little bit of a humorous edge. The idea is to really look at stories that are happening in people's neighborhoods. And I guess hopefully not take ourselves too seriously.
Not too seriously. A little, not mean, I would say mean enough. Mean enough, because if someone puts a luxury building next to the Brooklyn House of Detention, someone needs to point that out. And that's going to be you.
We like to take a little bit of the wind out of everybody's sails. So the preservationists tend to think that we're a little too hard on them, and the developers think we're a little too hard on them. But the goal is to kind of... call it like we see it.
Uh-huh. And the buyers and the renters, that's who your audience is, and that's really all you care about?
No, I think the site Curbed, a lot of people who read Curbed tell me that they're not that interested in real estate per se, and that's why what we try and do on the site is, for real estate junkies, we really do dig into real estate issues. But we also try to show some of the fun stuff and give a little bit of slice of life stories from people's neighborhoods so you don't have to... be completely obsessed with real estate. I hope to find the site kind of a fun read.
And you know what's good about it? The comments, more so than a lot of websites, which sometimes are just stupid and vitriolic, good comments on your site.
Hey, our commenters are amazing. I mean, a lot of what makes Curb go in general are the readers. I mean, we got our best tips from our readers, and the comments are free. Everyone's welcome to kind of jump in. And at times, things can get a little bit, out of control, like everything on the internet. But I'm always amazed at how much our readers know about what's going on around New York, and there really is very rarely a time where we put something up where readers don't embellish the story or really know, able to really lay out some facts that, really add to everybody's enjoyment and understanding of the issue we're talking about.
Last week you were here, you talked a lot about the national slump in the housing market. If you're a real estate site, how could you not talk about this?
Right.
The new headline for this week is something that New Yorkers might take for granted, that many fewer people in New York own property than the national average. That's not a news flash, but, is there some interesting context you could comment about?
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those stats that I actually sometimes tell people just because it surprises them, although it often is non-New Yorkers, that it's only about a third of New Yorkers who actually own property. It's two-thirds of New Yorkers rent. And nationally, the numbers are exactly the opposite. It's about two-thirds of people who own and one-third who rent. So that's not new news. And I think the context is that it's such a unique market here in New York, and you look at things like rent regulation, you look at things like rent stabilization. There are certain things that have kept people in rentals over the years where, 20 or 30 years ago, someone might have been in a position to buy. But, if they had a great rent, then they may still have that rent. I think as those programs start to be phased out, there's certainly been a lot of political pressure on them over the last 5 years, if not longer, you start to see those numbers change a little bit.
For the better, you think? I mean, what's your take on rent control overall? Which is what? Like asking you about abortion or some other third rail issue?
Yeah, exactly right. I think it's done a lot to make New York the special place it is. I also think there are good reasons why, where New York is now, those rules can get a little outmoded. And you look at some of the situations with people, literally someone paying $300 living next door to someone who's paying, $3,000. I think you have to say, wow, that's a little wacky at some point. But I think it's done a lot to, for why New York's neighborhoods are as vibrant and, as they are. And I'm not sure I know the answer, as you point out, but it certainly continues to be a real hot button issue.
No, I didn't point out that you don't know the answer. I thought you would. But that was a good answer. Here, I got right here the New York Sun. You could hear the actual Sun. Headline, Market Tilts to Buyers of Real Estate. Signs of shift become evident in Manhattan. It's a trend piece, so they try to pull together some disparate strings. And among the things they're citing is one of these buildings in Hell's Kitchen is actually paying the broker's fees, right, including the state and city transfer taxes. And then in some other building, I think on 23rd, they were upping the commission that brokers got, I guess, to light a fire under them.
Yeah.
Is this really a trend, or, just in often here and there, a building has to do what it can to move some units?
I mean, what we're talking about here are new development buildings, and I was talking about those last week with Brian a little bit. You know, there are a lot of new developments that have gone up around town, and they have been priced often at the very high end of sort of their range of prices. So you're looking at one-bedroom apartments that are at the absolute, for their neighborhoods in different places, really at the top end of where you might buy in that neighborhood. And what I think you're going to see is you're going to see some price corrections that I don't think are going to mean that these prices are getting slashed in half, but they're going to have, people are going to be looking around the neighborhood, and not everybody wants to be paying top dollar for a, you know, granite countertop and a sub-zero fridge. And that's really what a lot of these new developments, they're really the sort of turnkey lifestyle. Like, oh my God, I want to move in tomorrow. And I, you know, okay, well, that makes sense for some people. But if, as we start to see Wall Streeters getting hit a little bit by this economy, I think a fair number of those people who would be the ones who really want to move in tomorrow.
Yeah.
Are, you know, hey, a lot of people would rather buy a place and put a little, you know, elbow grease into it and recognize a little upside on fixing it up. And I think some of these new developments are just going to have to price in their neighborhoods, you know, relative to what else is out there in terms of the market.
This is Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer and WNYC. We're talking to Lockhart Steel of Curb.com. Our number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-WNYC. And for people who are calling, I'll just cut them off at the knees because I'm sure everyone's asking this question. Is it a good time to buy? What do you think?
Listen, I think buying in New York, it's always a good time to buy. Or the better way to put it is it's like investing in the stock market. The more you think about it, the more it's just going to drive you completely crazy. So
right. To time it at that exact moment. But if you take a 20-year window, yeah, it'll probably go up. If you take a 15-year window.
Like, I don't want to sound like one of these brokers, because this is what the brokers are always saying too, is like, hey, New York is immune to problems. And I don't believe that. I just think if you've got... if you can get the money together and make a down payment and you're ready to move into a place, then, like, yeah, the time to buy is now. And I think it's pretty clear that the top is off the complete insanity of the market. And the question is just what's going to happen over the next year. And, geez, if I knew, I would I'd be making a fortune. And I promise you I'm not. So.
Well, let's tell you, a second ago you mentioned Wall Street. To what extent does Wall Street key a lot, or if not everything, we see in the New York markets? I mean, if the stock market goes down and if those famous Wall Street bonuses and those hedge fund bonuses aren't there, what's the ripple effect?
Well, you know, it's another one of those great questions that everyone likes. I mean, the Curb commenters in particular love to debate this one. And there are some people who really feel strongly that as Wall Street goes, so goes the entire New York real estate market. There are a lot of other people who say as Wall Street goes, it doesn't really matter. They're just the ones snapping up these $7 million penthouses, and that's not really indicative of the larger market as a whole, where most people are buying in the, you know, $300,000, $500,000, $750,000 range. Again, so smart people disagree on it. I tend to think it's going to have a little more of an impact than some people do, but, you know, a lot of that's going to depend on how hard Wall Street really is hit and whether we're just seeing a certain number of hedge funds, you know, get hit by the subprime stuff, or how much larger that's going to spread across sort of all of Wall Street.
And this is a non sequitur of a question, but I've always wondered this. A New York one, I always see this commercial about a building, I think, in Queens, and there's an elephant in the shower. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think that's it.
What is the elephant in the shower selling point?
We've written about that on Curb because we love to pick apart some of the absurd marketing schemes. I think the elephant in the shower is supposed to tell you, and this is, of course, one of these great new development selling points, that the bathrooms are huge, and everyone now, I guess, wants big bathrooms.
And the floors are strong.
I don't know, and there's a tiger in the hallway or something.
And you can have animals in the building. No dogs above 50 pounds, but elephants are fine.
It's crazy. Long Island City is crazy these days, what can I tell you?
Yeah, I know. I was just there the other day, and four elephants were walking down the street saying, where can I find a shower? A second ago, you said... I don't want to sound like one of these brokers. Here's another fundamental third rail question, like rent control. Shakespeare said, first kill all the lawyers. What if we did that to the brokers? Not kill them, but, you know, gave them nice jobs as kindly gentlemen farmers or something. I mean, do they help the buyer? Who are they helping besides themselves?
Well, I mean, listen, it's an interesting trend that's playing out in a much... that's one of those trends that we're seeing much larger outside New York City than in New York, is a lot of people moving to the for sale by owner model, where... at least on the seller side, you basically are doing the job yourself, or with a little bit of help from, like, there's a website out there called Redfin.com that in certain markets like Seattle and San Francisco now has taken a huge role in essentially taking over a lot of the broker responsibility. And they're, instead of taking 3% of the as the seller broker, they're only going to take 1%. So basically, if you're doing a $500,000 transaction, they're going to save you $30,000 or so. But in New York, the market is so tricky, and navigating, especially when you're buying, if you're buying into a co-op, navigating the co-op boards, that whole craziness.
Right.
I think there's no question that brokers provide a value. It's just that as people do spend more time on the internet, especially researching real estate before they buy, or you hear stories of people showing up to a broker meeting with, you know, 30 listings they've printed out off of Craigslist or the New York Times listing service, or little bits and pieces they've picked up on the real estate blogs like Curbed and Brownstoner. I think brokers used to sort of be this vault of information, and you would go to them and sort of hope that they would enlighten you. And the reality is that consumers now have a lot more of that information at their fingertips. And so it doesn't mean brokers are outmoded, but it does mean brokers have to evolve a little bit from what they've always done, which is sort of be able to tell you like, hey, we're going to tell you what, you know, this neighborhood is about, to really helping you through the process more and making sure that, you know, they're really helping you identify value, because brokers obviously are going to know the market probably better than most buyers. And, you know, in that way, I think they still have a role to play, but it's definitely evolving, and it's going to be an interesting 10 years for the real estate industry.
Do you think brokers are still as important as they are because of pretty much pure market forces, that enough people think they still need them? Or
well,
are
listen,
they?
I think this is New York City, where we will pay people to do anything for us. We pay people to do our laundry for us. We pay people to, you know, and I think
the wash our elephants in their showers.
I mean,
yeah.
The real estate, looking for an apartment is hell. It's crazy. It can completely destroy a year of your life. And I think to sort of the idea that you're going to pay someone to help you, to seriously help you with that process, to New Yorkers is a really normal thing that I don't see changing for most people. I mean, there's always going to be people who want to save the money and do it themselves. But for the majority of people, you know, I think it still makes sense.
Another thing that Curb does, everyone wants to know about, you know, should I buy or should I sell? But you also have sort of an urban planning thing going on in your site.
Totally.
And you looked at, just for an example, you looked at Lower Manhattan, what's going to happen at the World Trade Center site.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about how Greenwich Street is being extended southward.
That's right.
Sort of. I was just at, I was just overlooking the site, talking to the guy who's in charge of building the memorial. And it's there. I mean, there's a street right there. It attaches to Greenwich Street. It seems pretty much inevitable. What's your take on this?
Well, listen, it was one of those big issues that, you know, they're sort of rebuilding the grid is an urban planning. The people who, you know, urban planners love that idea. And they think that the sort of super blocks that were built to build the World Trade Center, you know, back in the 70s, you know, basically disrupted the neighborhood in a great way. And that reconnecting these blocks is a way to, you know, make that neighborhood more vibrant. You know, they put out Silverstein, Larry Silverstein, the developer, put out the final plans for towers 2, 3, and 4 at the World Trade Center site. Those are going to be the towers that flank sort of the western or the eastern edge of the site.
Right. You know, they'll be facing the Hudson.
Exactly. Yeah. Not the Freedom Tower, but the other three. And what was interesting, I thought it would get a little more media coverage, but the media didn't talk as much about it as I thought they would, was what these buildings are going to look like at the ground level. And they're all sort of very vibrant, interesting buildings.
Lots of glass, very futuristic.
Very futuristic, lots of retail space. And it's just, it's either going to, I think it's either all going to come together or it could all fall apart. It's going to be interesting to see.
And one, I don't know if it was you or, you know, a commenter, but they talked about, I think it was maybe the Sir Richard Rogers building,
right,
that it looks almost like something from the Transformers movie, where it could possibly swoop down and attack you.
Absolutely.
With its two giant spires.
Yeah, I mean, these are three buildings. That's Tower 3. These are three towers that... you know, they're pretty different looking. You know, you have Norman Foster has architected Tower 2 and Richard Rogers Tower 3 and persons whose name I won't try and pronounce, architected Tower 4, Fumihaki. Or,
yes,
or
Japanese architect.
Yeah, and it's three very different buildings that, as I said, it's either, I think, going to sort of work as this sort of playpen of architecture, or people might look at it and think like, oh my God, how did this happen? What was going on here?
Do you think that, I know that in the planning for the World Trade Center site, I mean, so much attention is paid. And of course, in your site, they're paying attention. But do you think the average person really reads into it as much as the people on your site?
No, I mean, I think like at this level of detail, I mean, I think the average person cared a lot about what's going to happen at Ground Zero. I think the average person cared about what the memorial was going to look like. I think the average person cared about the Freedom Tower. When we start getting down to the details of what are going to be essentially three office towers, yeah, you have to have a certain fascination of architecture and a certain fascination for urban planning, but that's kind of the type of thing that Curb caters to, or people who are, you know, fascinated by that.
If I asked you, and there's a caller who wants to know, but maybe this is to show your level of detail about any building in New York. He's writing about a Grand Army Plaza. There's a new building up. It's a Richard Meier building on One Prospect Park. I mean, off the top of your head, you know that one?
Yeah, I do. It's a big, it's one of those big glassy developments. I mean, he did the Meier Street Towers, you know, that are along the West Side Highway now down in the West Village. Kind of took the architectural ideas that he developed there and he's doing them right on Prospect. The address is 1 Prospect Park. They're calling the building on Prospect Park, and it's another one of these glassy palaces where, you know, the main point of, I think, of you're almost living in a glass box and here looking out over, you know, Prospect Park in Brooklyn.
Very quickly, what's one maybe smaller or niche building that you love that you think gets it right? Something new that's a great trend.
My favorite street in New York right now is Bond Street in NoHo. You have Ian Schrager built 40 Bond, which is, to me, architecturally the best thing anyone's built in New York in the last couple of years. And on the same block, you have 2 other buildings, 48 Bond and 25 Bond. Each of them architecturally are really interesting and unique, and yet they all seem to fit into what was essentially this, you know, low-scale neighborhood, you know, sort of classic cast-iron architecture.
Yep.
And to me, it's really that street alone, that block, is a model of how architecture can really work, past and future.
Lockhart Steele, who is the editor and creator of Curb.com. I'm not going to call you an idiot, savant. A real estate savant. Thanks a lot, Lockhart.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.